Okay. Is this 12 or 13? I think it's the 13th class on January 15th, 2008. And this evening we're going to focus on the six realms. And in case of wondering, you're wondering why the flip chart and everything, it's a math class tonight. But I have reasons for it. I know, there are all those groans. I love it. Okay. For whatever reason, my own teacher, Rinpoche, Kala Rinpoche, greatly enjoyed teaching about the six realms, walking us through time and time again the sufferings of the hell realms and the hungry ghosts and the animals and the humans, titans, and god realms. And you may notice in the descriptions here, the two realms that are given the most weight are which? Pardon? The hell realms, one of them. Anybody read this over before? So which is, pardon? I think it's more the human realm. Really goes into a lot of detail about birth and old age, you know. The 10 inconceivable sufferings of old age.
You didn't live in LA.
No, where there are 100 inconceivable sufferings. The photographers stop coming around. The makeup artist says it's hopeless. The cameraman says we'll have to have a sharper focus than that. Okay. from last week, we talked about the three kinds of suffering: the suffering of or a struggle, or however you want to, whatever term you want to use. The suffering of existence, which is basically experienced ordinarily as a kind of neutrality. It's not experienced explicitly as suffering, but just a kind of slight sense that things aren't quite right. And then the suffering of change, which arises out of desire or attraction. And then and now we're going to talk about the suffering of suffering, which is arises out of aversion when things impinge on us. It's a way that we react to stuff that arises. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Yeah, that's better. Now, there are all kinds of translation problems in here. There are also all kinds of cultural problems. The Tibetan terms of, let's just review the six realms very quickly. You have the three lower realms and the three higher realms, which Gunther translates as evil and happy. I would say that it's would be probably more accurate to say, or more in keeping with the Tibetan, if these were the the bad places to be born and the good places to be born. So it's not about evil and happiness, which aren't even really comparable, but it's just subjectively speaking, these are the bad places because it's just untold suffering and unremitting suffering, and these are the good places because at least you get a break from time to time. So I'm going to turn to Khenchok Jaltsen's. What does he do here? Yes, he just calls them the higher and lower realms, which is the other designation. So in the lower realms, the hell realms, hungry ghost, and the animal realms. Now, I'm just going to see if I can clip that on. Let me know if you get any interference, because sometimes when I clip it on, it does. Tibetan cosmology, which was derived from Indian cosmology, medieval Indian cosmology, looked like this. There was a mountain. Please excuse my lack of artistic sense. This was Mount Meru, which is usually associated with Mount Kailash, which is in the northwest of India, and it's the western Tibet. Many people have been there, and it's a four-sided mountain. But you'll notice in this I've drawn it so that it's opening upwards. And then, this, if I remember correctly, this sat on a number of, you might say, platforms like this. I can't remember how many. And they're surrounded by oceans, rings of oceans and mountains. It's already running out of ink. Then, you also had various the continents and subcontinents. I can't remember all their shapes now. There's that one. No, I've got the shapes wrong, so I won't worry about the shapes now. There's one back there behind Mount Meru, and one over here. And then above here, you had Indra's palace, right at the top of this mountain. And then you had 17 form realms and four formless. And then right all through here and mixed up here, you had the animal realm. And then underneath that, underneath was the hungry ghost. And underneath that, you had the hot hells over here and the cold hells here. These were divided into eight levels each. And then there are a few other things, but we won't worry about those. Now, first off, what is this? It's a map of the world. This is India. This was probably Madagascar. This is Sri Lanka. Very crude map. And this was kind of China or those funny things over there, and this was Africa, and this was the stuff in northern Asia. But in these times, all of this was really felt to exist. And the sun and moon went around Mount Meru like this. And they were fairly good astronomers. And that was the picture. So when you were going around from life to life, you could be born here, you could be born here. The Titans lived here, the gods lived up here, they were always fighting here. And if you wanted to know why was the sky blue, it's because the side of Mount Meru was blue on this side. And it's a reflection that made the sky blue and the ocean blue. Over here it was red, over there it was yellow, and back there it was green. So you had different color skies in those directions. But this was the map which explained the world. It was their version of the Ptolemaic universe. Now, that's one way to understand it, and it's how it's often described. I mean, and there were debates about how far down was the deepest level of hell and so forth, which were roughly comparable to medieval arguments about how many angels could you put on the head of a pin, which actually was a very important theological debate, but I can't remember why. I mean, you can look it up in Wikipedia or something, but there was, it sounds trivial, but there was an actual important theological basis behind that. Now, this, of course, is not our cosmology. A friend of mine says, a culture's cosmology reflects their psychology. So if we look at this, this is all about emotional reaction. Because the way that we would tend to look at this, if we look at this in terms of mythic language, all of these different realms are coded language, coded descriptions for how we experience the world when we are consumed or in the grip of one or other of these reactive emotions. So when you are feeling above it all, you're in the God realm. And when you are really angry, we say he's burning with anger. It's, you know, he's red hot anger. And the Hungry Ghosts is about that realm is about greed, where there is, you just feel there isn't enough, and so forth. Now, I have a question for you. Here's our cosmology. We have the sun, affectionately referred to as soul. And, you know, at actually quite extraordinary distances, you know, I can't draw this possibly to scale, we have the various planets, and we have, you know, like Earth out here. Actually, Earth would be like that on the scale. But so there's an absolutely great deal of empty space. And if we expand this out and go into galactic things, we have all of these galaxies all over the place, you know, and billions and billions of miles between each one. You know, we measure it in light years, which is like a very long distance, and so forth. Even within these things, like they're 500 light years across or something ridiculous, which is a ridiculous distance. But the cosmology comes down to all of these spheres, stars and planets and things, suspended in infinite space. Now, the question that I pose myself is, what is the psychology behind this cosmology? Pardon? Independence. Well, you got there quickly. That only took me 5 years to get to that. How'd you get there so quickly? Hand Kara a microphone. Kara says, separation, independence.
Well, the Western psychology is more based on individuality and differentiation and separation. And the Eastern mindset is a lot more geared towards collectiveness and a collective consciousness.
Yeah. Well, that's very true. But I puzzled over this question for a long time. I eventually came to the same conclusion.
Get raised by psychologists.
Ah. I did not have that good fortune / curse. Anybody else? This makes sense to you? This is a cosmology in which people feel that they exist independently and are separated by huge distances with no real possibility of communication. I mean, in our cosmology, how far away is the nearest star other than the sun?
Four light years.
In Alpha Centauri. Do you know how long it takes to travel that? Hundreds of years. Even if you manage to ramp up to the speed of light, it still takes 4 years. And nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, Star Trek notwithstanding. Pat, take a microphone.
I also think that our cosmology is that we are the center of the universe. That even though we are that tiny little thing, we tend to think of ourselves as the only thing that exists.
I think that's true. I think that is actually a carryover from the creation myths in the Abrahamic religions.
Well, but I think it carries down to the psyche. It's like we are the only thing that exists,
yeah.
And therefore when it comes to the individual, it's all about us. So it kind of goes from the us as a planet to us as an individual.
I think you could read it, could look at it that way, yeah. But my main point here is this idea that our psychology is one of separate individual selves, which communication between which is virtually non-existent. It's rather a sad psychology. But in a certain sense, it certainly accounts for the extraordinary despair that arose in the 20th century with existentialism and so forth. So that's one thing I want to point out, that we're actually working with two very, very different cosmologies, and the consequence of that is two very, very different psychologies. Now, the map of the six realms is very useful to us because it describes how we experience the world when we are in the grip of the these reactive emotions. And so I don't think we have to... the reason I was presenting it in terms of psychology, cosmologies, is that we tend to think that our cosmology is the one true cosmology. No, it's only a way of interpreting our experience. It's a very powerful one because it explains many things, and among one of the things that makes this possible is the law of gravity, Newton discovered back in the 17th century, which makes all kinds of things possible, like satellites and global communications and things. But it doesn't necessarily mean, and this may sound very radical, that it's how things actually are. It's how we experience things. And it's how we experience things, and we find it useful when we want to do certain kinds of things. In terms of waking up, Western cosmology is not particularly useful. Susan.
I'm a little confused, although I feel like I'm about to walk into something, but...
Come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. Does anybody know that nursery rhyme? Yeah, I got it. What happened to all the good ones?
Okay, so Western cosmology, the way you've illustrated it and explained it, seems to be based upon scientific observation.
Absolutely.
So are you saying there's also subjectivity in that and it's not really objective?
Yes, I am. And science has done a wonderful propaganda job here. And I'm trained in math and physics, so I'm not speaking out of ignorance here. But it's a propaganda job. And the underlying assumption and what defines science as science is it only works with measurable quantities. Because if you can't measure it, then you can't talk about it. You can't build a model, etc., and mathematical model. We'll get to the math part later. Okay. So what the... And you remember, I think it was during the money and value workshop. I talked about frames. Okay. The frame that science presents is that only that which can be measured exists. And if you take that as the frame, then you get the scientific view, and from that point of view, only those things are real. Anything which can't be measured has no value in the scientific view. But that's only one way to look at human experience. And to say that is the one true way to look at our experience is the propaganda job. And that's why science, and many people have written about this, is the dominant religion of our age. Because that's an article of faith, only that which is measured exists. And fundamentalism is the reaction to that religion. It is also a modern phenomenon, but it arises because of the imposition or the attempt to impose the science, the scientific view, the rational view, as the one true view. There isn't one true view. There are just different frames. And when you look at things from the scientific point of view, all kinds of weird things happen. Among them is the undermining of confidence in your own experience. And this goes way back. Aristotle dropped a feather and a ball, and the feather goes down like this, and the ball goes chunk. So he came to certain conclusions from that. Fast forward a few hundred years, and Galileo drops a very light ball and a very heavy ball from the Tower of Pisa, supposedly. No one knows that it's actually happened, but it's the story. And they both fall at exactly the same rate. Even that's suspect, because he had to have a really good stopwatch to time it in that frame. And they didn't have that those kinds of clocks back then. But and if you are able to incorporate in other factors and things like that, because Aristotle couldn't incorporate in air resistance, like that wasn't a concept back then, and that's what makes the feather fall more slowly than the ball. If you're able to get rid of those factors and abstract things down to their very simple forms, which is exactly what mathematics does when you do mathematical modeling, then you get very different descriptions. They're non-intuitive descriptions, but they work much better. But the effect of those is that they undermine confidence in what you actually observe. Now fast forward to the 20th century. In order to be to have a valid thing, you have to be trained in a certain field. You have to be an expert in that field trained. And so the whole idea of knowledge now becomes that which is ordained as true by a certain body of people according to certain rules and not your own experience. So you can have psychologists telling you how you actually feel and why you're doing things. You go, well, that doesn't feel right, things like that. And that'll stand up in court against your own testimony. And that's just one area that it comes up in. So this has been very, very confusing to people. So people will accept an expert's opinion about their own situation, even when it contradicts their own experience. I think everybody's encountered that. Art, do you have a comment here?
I just sort of want to make sure I understand what you're saying. I understand and agree that from a scientific perspective, if you can't measure it, then it doesn't exist. I think that's their mindset.
And so they seek a way to measure whatever they want to study. It's the first thing you've got to establish metrics.
Right. But that doesn't necessarily negate the realm of measurements for an example. In other words, Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away. It's not in the glove compartment of my car. Or
depends
is
on
it?
Your perspective.
Seriously.
Well, what are you trying to hold on to here, Art? I love it.
I don't think I'm trying to hold on to anything.
Well, maybe.
It seems, here's how I viewed what you said, that the map of, as we currently understand the universe, if that's a, I don't necessarily know if that's an outcome of our collective psychology as much as it might be a Rorschach test, where we see the measurements and then we project onto it that we're distant and separate. I mean, somebody else could look at that and go, you know, it's something else completely different. But the raw measurements of that are what they are.
Can I borrow a piece of paper? Blank piece of paper. Thank you. Pardon? Well, there's a fairly complicated way of determining, and according to those, that their distances are absolutely accurate.
It's accurate to what?
Well, that's what we're getting to.
Not the paper again.
The paper again. I'm sorry, as this comes from Trungpa Rinpoche.
He's like that Marilyn Monroe Einstein thing.
The Marilyn Monroe?
Joe DiMaggio, Marilyn Monroe. And have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's Joe DiMaggio, Marilyn Monroe, and who's the third one? Come on, you know what I'm talking about. And they all get together and explain the theory of the law of relativity. One night, the three of them.
That sounds fun. Is it on YouTube or anything?
Yeah, it was turned into a movie.
Okay. Big, small, right?
Yes.
Big, small.
Yes.
Okay.
Or big, bigger.
So, what is this, big or small?
It's relative to what you hold up next to it.
Thus with all measurements. Going to talk. Use a microphone, please.
Okay, but how do we know what Earth really...
Well, this is the point. There isn't any absolute reference point.
Right.
That is what's behind your question, Art. Now, I in no way am I saying that, you know, I can reach out and touch Alpha Centauri. I'm too thoroughly conditioned in this culture to do so. That's one way of putting it. My point in presenting this is that just as the six realms are a frame, a mm-hmm. way of looking at our experience, which has certain uses, so our scientific way is a way of looking at our experience, which has certain uses,
right.
Very powerful uses. You know, I love technology, and I enjoy my computer, and that's all made possible by that particular framework.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important, if we're going to be awake, to recognize these things as frameworks,
right.
And that the scientific way of interpreting experience is only one way of interpreting experience and understanding experience, mm-hmm. because there's all kinds of things that we talk about here which don't come under the scientific point of view, and hence don't exist in that framework.
Got it, yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
Kara, you had a question.
It's kind of a jumble, but just relative to what you wrote, never mind.
Go for it.
Okay, well, you're talking about, like, medieval models of the universe. So, like, with what you drew, for those of you playing at home, if you get a piece of paper...
I guess I'll have to do a quick sketch of this and throw it up on Facebook, won't I?
Totally.
Oh, great.
So you have the sun, you know, as the dominant body, and then the Earth as the smaller outlying body.
Yeah.
And you're talking about that influencing our cultural psychology and
that way
cosmology.
Of looking at things.
Right. Yeah. But when this would have been developed, this map of the six realms that you've drawn up, more than likely in the West, we still would have been of the flat Earth, or Earth is the dominant property in the universe mm-hmm. mindset. So, I mean, that is a much better example of how our psychology has evolved both scientifically, I think, and spiritually.
Oh, I think that's a good point. So you're saying I should have done a comparison within the culture rather than cross culture?
No, I'm just saying, like, just relative to the evolution of our, the strict evolution, because it's only a recent, in the last 500 years, phenomenon that we've actually decided that we're not.
Yes, we moved from being geocentric to heliocentric to no center. And that, as you say, it has been a rapid evolution. Yeah. Randy.
I guess my objection is making that leap from cosmology to psychology, because initially, if you recall, the first astronomers were Chinese, which is an Eastern culture, collectivist culture, not an individualistic culture.
Yeah.
And they operated very much on an integrated model of each individual fitting into the culture as a part of a whole. And they were the first astronomers, not Westerners.
Yes, but let's be careful here. I don't know what Chinese astronomical theory is, but the Assyrians were astronomers way back, and very good astronomers. They had very, very precise measurements of things, but they never thought that it was the Earth moving around an object. It was the center of things, and all of those things were moving around the Earth. So it was a geocentric model, like the Ptolemaic, which evolved out of that system. And the only reason that there was a move from the geocentric and the Ptolemaic models to the heliocentric was because Tycho Brahe, and after him Copernicus, and then Galileo, Tycho Brahe's measurements were so precise they could no longer be explained. Or they could be explained, but it produced a very, very complicated theory. And one of the principles of science is you only use the theory which is complicated. And by shifting it from the geocentric to the heliocentric, you got a much, much simpler theory. Pardon?
It was more parsimonious.
Yeah, it's Occam's razor.
But I thought you were referring to, like, the whole galactic model where you have individual bodies that are separate, representing whatever individual beings or individual psyches.
Well, you have, I mean, if we look at our galactic model, if you want to interpret it psychologically, and I'm just saying it's one, is you have these galaxies which are millions of light years apart, and in each of these there are hundreds of millions of stars, but even those are so far apart that they can't really communicate, even though they influence each other very significantly. And to me, it is a cosmology which really puts it's all about action at a distance and no real communication or connection. I mean,
the influence is inexorable.
Yeah. But the influences are inexorable, exactly. Anyway, I don't want to spend much longer on that. I just want to offer this as a framework. And we are so in the thrall of the scientific worldview and the rational worldview that we often don't recognize how thoroughly it permeates our thinking. I mean, the whole the dominant model of Western science now, and neuropsychology and everything, is that awareness is an epiphenomenon, at best an emergent phenomenon, of neurochemical activity. Okay, so I'm sitting here and I'm just this fluky product, and everything you're hearing is this fluky product of chemicals and electricity flying around in me. It has no meaning, zero. But that's not your experience, and that's not my experience. This is what I mean about the scientific worldview undermining our experience. And it leads to other things like the binding problem, what makes our experience my experience, and so forth. But I don't want to get into all of that this evening. Returning to the six realms. So, what I asked you to do over the last week was to look at the experience of these six realms and see if you could identify any of the descriptions which resonated with you in particularly emotional states. Let's hear from a few people. Did anybody, hope you had a chance to do that. Did you, any of you find anything which reminded you? Susan, you're wearing the expression which says you did. So, have a microphone. Be generous.
Well, from time to time, you know, when I remember, it's actually interesting for me as I go through my day, to note what realm comes up. Well, what realm I can label my experience as, mm-hmm. as it occurs. So that's pretty interesting. And depends upon what's going on, but there's animal realm, and to my surprise, Titan.
Your surprise. Okay. Diane. There you are, slaving for this big corporation right in the animal realm, I suspect.
Yeah, well, that too. I noticed that there were different realms for work and different realms for my personal life that seemed uh-huh. to pop up.
So which one, what operates in your work, what operates in your personal life?
Well, in the work, it was either the animal realm or it was actually the God realm. You know, things were going quite well and...
You're above it all and just wish everybody else did things the way you did.
Exactly.
And then everything would be fine.
Yeah, because I'm right, and that's just the way it is.
We're learning our lines.
Right. Okay. So, but in my personal life, I had a very interesting experience with the Titan realm. And I was talking with a friend of mine, and I started to feel this feeling like I wasn't... it's hard to describe. It was like there's something wrong with me, like this nagging little something wrong with me, and I couldn't figure out where it was coming. It was just very odd, and the more I explored it, though, it actually was anger.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, so
okay,
that was interesting.
not fun, but interesting. Okay.
Well, the ten inconceivable sufferings of aging sounds like it's something I can think about.
But we'll get to that in a minute, Chuck.
The human realm, I think.
You enjoy things and you work hard to enjoy right. things and you enjoy them and then you work hard again to enjoy them.
Right. And things sort of dissipate and you have to work hard again.
Yeah, okay, all right. Anybody over here? Yeah, Diane? Okay. Anybody over here?
I live in them.
You live in all of them.
Well, the hell realm, there's so many. It's like there's just one door and then you go in another one and you go in. I mean, I read the hell realms and I just couldn't believe there were. They're like. They're like pools.
Do you recognize yourself in these realms?
I think the hungry ghost in a way more mm-hmm. than. I always see that. I've seen that painting, or maybe it's been described in another place where the throat is tiny.
That's right.
And you can't get any food. Where is that from?
Oh, there's all kinds of descriptions of that.
But
it's
there's
in here.
A painting where I've actually seen that throat somewhere. It's okay. Like a beak. And mm-hmm. it's a really skinny beak with a huge mouth, almost like the famous painting, it's not the Scream, but I've seen it. It's like a beak okay. and a huge mouth, and it has a tiny little skinny neck. But you said greed. I don't see it as greed. I see it as you get a moment of satisfaction, and then you kind of go, okay, that's done. Now what's the next problem?
That's more human realm.
In the
hungry ghost realm, there's never any sense of satisfaction. And that's the difference between the two realms, those two realms. If you get to enjoy something, even if it's only fleeting, that's human realm.
That's
what Chuck, yeah. But in the hungry ghost realm, you're grasping, grasping, grasping. Even when you get something, you don't enjoy it because your greed is so great.
Mm. Sounds almost the same.
Okay. That's the distinction. Okay. Anybody else? Diane?
Is it on?
Yep.
I was trying to figure out which of the hell realms it was.
Hold it like this.
I was trying to figure out which of the hell realms it was, and it turns out that it was the number one all-pervasive suffering. No, the suffering of change.
Okay.
That's in the hell realm, right?
No, the suffering of change is the second. All the realms are in the third, the suffering of suffering.
Oh, okay. Well.
And there are ways that when we are gripped by one or other of the six reactive emotions in this particular map, that's how we experience the world. So when we're in the grip of anger, then we experience the world in one of two ways. And I'm going to run through them just to be clear about these. When we're in the grip of anger, we experience the world in one of two ways. Either anger is felt as something burning, which is what gives rise to the descriptions of the hot hells, and it can be burning from the inside and can be different degrees of burning from the inside. There's the black thread hell where we experience being sliced again very, very finely by searingly hot saws and razors. People can relate to anger that way. That's what anger feels like. It's just they're being sliced that way. Or the crushing hells, being crushed by red hot rocks that are tumbling all around you and so forth. Some people experience anger as just closing in and crushing them. But all of those have the image of heat and that quality of heat. The other way that anger arises is as hatred. And hatred is cold where anger is hot. And that's why you have these the cold hells, where when you hate something, it's really difficult to move and change. Hot anger is much more volatile, and it can change, but hatred is far more difficult to change. It's really in the system. That's why it's the image of being frozen, of ice, where every movement, if you really hate something and somebody comes in with some evidence or a some aspect of the situation which you have to acknowledge, so it means you have to change. It's actually excruciatingly painful because you have to adjust within that hatred, and that's why it says when you move your finger, the skin cracks apart, and that's what's referring to. Now, you notice in the descriptions of the hot hells and the cold hells, they have these rather large numbers. Oh, it goes way beyond 20,000. It's like into the billions and trillions and so forth. Yeah. Describing the length of time here. Yes, I think, what is it? One, two, three, so that's up to billions, trillions, quadrillions. So yeah, in the lowest hell, the second lowest hell, the seventh hell, it's 53 quintillion years. That's a long time. Now, why these big numbers? And they have similarly big numbers for the gods' realms because they're correlated. And there are two points here. First, I want to talk about why these big numbers from a cultural perspective. And to do that, I need to give you a little math lesson, which is why I bought this. Now, mathematics is all about notation. Well, that's a bit much, but notation's crucial. So when you start to count, how do you count? Suppose you're sitting in jail and all you've got is a rock to mark off the days. What do you do? One. And then the next day passes and you go. And next day passes, you go. What do you do at this point? Cross. Why do you cross them? Yeah, but why? What's the reason behind it? Pardon?
To bundle them into a new number.
Yeah, because once you get too many, it's hard to tell how many are there, but you put that in, and there's still five strokes there, but now it's very easy to tell that there are five strokes. It's a form of notation, okay? So you're still in jail.
Easy for you to say.
But you run into the same problem after a while. So now what do you do? I mean, we got four bundles there. Now, yeah, so what's the system? Well, the Greeks, they tried something. They tried naming numbers letters. So the first alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, I can't remember. That's good enough for our purposes. So they tried this system. Now, what happens here? This is basically what the Assyrians did. They did things like that. There was a bit more developed, and I'm going to come back to that. Now, let's just write a very simple mathematical equation, okay? In English, it looks like, in our script, it looks like this. That's not too hard, right? And how many of you are familiar with Excel? How many of you have had to program a spreadsheet that has more than 26 columns? What happens when you get into the next after 26? Because the first 26 is just A, B, C, D. What happens next?
It goes to AA.
It goes to AA. See, we get into the same problem. How do you call this? And then you get that. Now, so developing these numbers, developing a notation for larger numbers is difficult. Now, the Romans, they were a little more sophisticated. You have I, but when you got up to this, you got V. And rather than doing that, you went 1, 2, 3, and then you went IV, which showed you took 1 away, and then you got to V, which is 5. And this worked quite well. They could write down a lot of numbers. Has anybody ever tried to do addition or multiplication in Roman numerals? It's really, addition's not too bad, subtraction's not too bad, it's a bit messy. Do not try long division. It's really hard in Roman. Yeah, I just,
even V plus V equals X isn't very intuitive.
No, it isn't. But yeah, but so this is actually a problem. Now there's another thing we need to look at.
This is a hell realm.
It's going to get worse, Patricia. It's going to get much worse. Okay. Anybody heard of 360? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a full turn. Why 360? Why not 100? Well, this goes back to Assyria again. Because in this system, you know, oops, well, too many there. How do you represent fractions? No, you don't have a decimal point. How do you represent fractions here? You don't. So that's why you used a number like 12. What's half of 12? Nice whole number. What's a quarter of 12? Thank you.
I'm doing third grade math right now.
What's a third of 12? Four, you see? So, yes, a third of 12 is 4. Okay, so you didn't need to use fractions because you had all of these things. Now, if you said, what's a fifth of 12, you had a little bit of a problem. So, and fifths would often come in handy. So what's 5 times 12? There we are. Now you can take all of this. That's why we have the clock dial has 60 minutes. This is where it comes from. And if you want to develop a system which really isn't going to involve many fractions, 6 times 60 is 360. That's where it comes from. So this number base, the 12-base number and the 60-base number system, was developed to avoid fractions. Okay? Now, fractions were eventually developed. Let us go to India now. And we're going to go to our familiar Arabic numeral system. What are the numbers? Call them out. Start with 1, okay? This is not too difficult. 2.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Now what?
10, 0.
What? What's zero?
There's no zero.
Ten is its own number. But it said 1, 0.
Count your fingers.
Yeah, but okay, that's what you can count your fingers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But what do you do now? How do you represent a full hand? Well, I know how to represent a full hand. I'm going to draw a hand. You know. Well, yeah, but you know, but I can just say this stands for that. Okay, so now I have hand 1, that would be 11, and hand, okay. Does this work very well? No, we're back into the same problem as the Roman numerals. So, what happened in India, I'm not sure when it happened, is they invented something. They invented this number. It was one of the greatest inventions in man's history, in human history. Why? Because now it became possible, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now we put a 1 and a 0, because the 0 stands for the 1s. And the 1 stands for 2 hands, 10 fingers, you see. Now what happens? I can have 10 of the 10s, just by adding another 0. And then another 0. And then another 0. How large a number can I construct?
You can just go on and on and on.
And that's exactly what they did. That's why you have all these big numbers here.
They wanted a lot of hell realms.
No, because somebody had discovered this, and they just went crazy, making up arbitrarily large numbers because they could. They couldn't do it up to that point.
This is just enthusiasm over the latest invention?
Exactly. No, because now they had to use metaphors, this huge pile of sesame seeds and somebody coming, one bird coming once a century to take one sesame away. And when that whole pile had disappeared, like as 80 bushels or something like that, but actually the one I heard is a pile of sesame seeds a mile wide and a mile high and 2 miles wide. And once a century, a bird comes and takes away one seed. And when that pile has disappeared, one day of eternity has passed. Or one day in the deepest hell realm has passed, But now you can, and if you look in the Tibetan dictionary, which comes from this, they have lists of these things with each one of these numbers having a different name, because somebody would name a number this and somebody would name a number that. And this is what happens whenever there's a new invention. This is what Baroque music was. In Baroque music, they discovered how to make instruments that could play all of these different notes, and they just went crazy making up all of this wonderful music. And now we have the same thing with technology, computers and all kinds of gadgets. That's what people do. Now, yeah, because now you can make arbitrary numbers and you can manipulate and write them down very, very easily. But the reason this is very important to us is that there was also something else that the Indians introduced into Buddhism, more or less around the same period, which has a great deal of connection with zero. Emptiness. Exactly, emptiness, which is one of the great things in like the possibility of not being a thing. That spiritually has just as profound an impact and creates just as many possibilities, if not more, as the number zero does. And they're very related concepts, which is why I wanted to introduce you to this. I hope that wasn't too painful for you, Pat.
No, I actually was thinking this whole
Please night. Use the microphone.
I actually was thinking this whole night about something that I don't think you're going to want to think about. I never looked at the realms before and wondered whether the caste system had any influence on that in India.
I have no idea. I just don't know.
I knew you were going to want to think about it. But it's interesting that a country that has had such a strong caste system would also have a religion or a philosophy that would have such a tight system of putting things into realms or into beliefs about, kind of an order.
Well, I think the caste system and the system of rebirth and that you're born into a caste came out of, as things often do, is a way of preserving social order. I'm not sure. You see that there's nothing implicit in the six realms that implies or leads to a caste system.
Only in the system. I was looking at them tonight and thinking it's interesting that they had such a system for the way they saw themselves as people.
Okay.
Yeah. I never really thought of it that way before.
Okay. Randy.
I'd read somewhere that the focus on numbers and counting and putting things into a very orderly system was because of the lack of writing, that most of the information was passed down verbally, and it's easier to memorize six of this and three of that. And
that's where all the lists come from, absolutely. Yeah. It was to facilitate memorization. But these arbitrarily large numbers had nothing to do with that. That was the discovery of zero. And you could just play and have fun. The other big discovery, just to complete the thing, was the decimal point. Because once you had the decimal point, then you could write arbitrarily small numbers. And does anybody know what a Google is, though?
It's one with a million zeros.
It's actually 100. Yeah, and a Googleplex. Yeah, that's a very large number. Yeah. Yeah. 100 zeros? There's a George, not Asimov, Gamow, was a Russian mathematician, physicist who wrote a book, 1, 2, 3, Infinity, back in the 50s. And in it, he was discussing large numbers. And he said, I'm just going to say, just so we can talk about really large numbers, like the number of atoms in the universe and so forth, let's say one with 100 zeros after it. We're going to call that a Google. And then he came up with a Googleplex, was 10 to the power of a Google, which is, but that's where the term Google comes from.
So what does it say about our civilization that we got rid of all those zeros by inventing power notation?
I'll leave that one to you, Randy. Okay. So when you're reading this, why these very, very long periods of time in either the God realm or the hell realm? I mean, really long periods of time, 53 quintillion years by the American numbering system. Kara?
To backtrack a little bit, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. So within the confines of the Hindu structure, within Hinduism, there's not a whole lot of focus on the afterlife. There's a lot of focus on the next life, like the being born again.
Yeah.
Which would go very far to explain the caste system and societal order. So
the afterlife is just regarded as an intermediate state.
The next birth.
That's right.
Headed on towards the cessation of samsara, whatever that ends up being. But would you say that the development of the realms, not the development, but the doctrine behind it, and I'm lacking in adjectives for this, but would you say that that's a reaction to that this sort of like if you were of the lowest class in Hindu society, the development of the realms or your ability to now focus your attention on the realms if you became a Buddhist would be a way for you to explain or cessate your suffering? Am I making any sense?
Yes, you are. This is samsara, okay? We haven't talked about the possibility of getting out of samsara. What the Marxist view of religion is that it was a way of promising or appearing to promise a better future for people so that you could enslave them in the present.
Well, so in that sense, then Buddhism is just a better way to dope up the masses, right?
Except that Buddhism wasn't actually ever used. Buddhism itself, or the way it developed, wasn't used for that purpose. Was it subsequently used for that purpose? Yes, but that wasn't the rationale behind Buddhism at all. Mm-hmm. It was very much to chart a way out of this. Okay, so what was my question before? Why the animal and the hell and the god realms appear such large periods of time? Anybody? Perry?
When I'm suffering, time passes very, very slowly.
Yep. Well, what about the God realm? You have to go a little bit further. You're in the right direction, but it's not quite about suffering. Who do the gods think about?
No one but themselves.
Right. This is the point. When your attention is focused on yourself, the more highly developed or more explicit the sense of yourself is, the more slowly time passes, subjectively speaking.
So you don't
know that. So when you have a headache, it seems to last forever. Depression seems to just time really slows down. Everything drags by. So when you're preoccupied with a sense of self, then time passes, seems to pass very, very slowly. What if you're having fun? What if you're completely engaged in something? How quickly does time pass? Time flies very, very quickly. So when you're not feeling any separation, there is no sense of time. Yeah. So the relationship between time and the sense of self is very, very close. And that's what those large numbers are referring to. I'm trying to show you how to read this text. So, okay. Now, how are we doing? Okay, we're good. A few points. The hell realm and the God realm represent the extremes. It's where you experience the most separation from your experience. One, because you're consumed by the anger. One, because you are feel you are above it or different from it all. The next two realms, the Titan realm and the Hungry Ghost realm, these are both based on a sense of deficiency. In the Hungry Ghost realm, that sense of deficiency is projected onto the world. There isn't enough out there. And you are so infused by that mentality that it doesn't matter what comes, you don't enjoy it. And that's why you have the image of some of the hungry ghosts. As soon as they take hold of something, it turns into flame or it turns into excrement or something. There's no possibility of enjoying it. In the Titan realm, the sense of deficiency is projected inwardly. That is, it's not that the world isn't providing enough, it's that I am not enough. So there's a whole identity built out of that sense of deficiency. What this leads to is a need to achieve, an insatiable need to achieve. You've got to achieve one thing after another. I read in the New Yorker many years ago an account of Eric Fromm. He was the psychoanalyst, right? Yeah. And I mean, this is one of the great psychologists of the 20th century, who had a very far-reaching influence on how Freud's work was interpreted and practiced subsequently. He died feeling that he was a failure. Why? Because he hadn't won the Nobel Prize. Insatiable need to achieve. The deficiency was inside. And it didn't matter that he had influenced psychology and psychiatry in this way. It didn't matter that his books were widely read. It didn't matter that he hadn't achieved the pinnacle, etc. Linnea, did you have a question? Art, could you hand her a mic?
So is the sense of don't they know who I am?
Perfectly expressed. Don't they know who I mean, that could be God realm as well.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, is that God or is
it? It's right. It could be either. But thank you for that. That's great. And when you have that feeling of specialness, that's a bit more. To differentiate, don't they know who I am is more the God realm. I will show them who I am is more the Titan realm. I mean, from the God realm, you can't believe that nobody knows who you are. I haven't had a celebrity come to my office, a minor celebrity. Her secretary was setting up the appointment and says, do you know who so-and-so is? And I just said, no. And there was this shocked silence on the other end of the phone. Pat.
So I have a question.
It's on.
On the Titan realm, so just like holding up that piece of paper, the size is relative.
Yes.
He made a decision that he was a failure if he didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize. So he picked that.
Nobel Prize for, I don't think there is one for psychology.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he picked that as the bar, as the bar for success or failure. So he held up that size piece of paper. So the suffering is the size of the paper that you hold up in your perception in the Titan realm.
Oh, very much. But look at what happens with people in their careers. When you start off in your career, you think, you know, I'd really like to earn $60,000-$70,000. That would be a nice salary. So you get to $67,000, you think, I'm on $100,000. You get to $100,000, think, I'm worth more than this. I can earn two. And after, it's never enough. You just keep going up.
No, but I actually think it goes the other way. So you make 100, and then 2 years later, you don't. And now you think, wow, what happened to me? I made 100 2 years ago.
Yeah, I must be. There must be something wrong. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so you're screwed no matter what you do.
If you're basing your sense of who you are in terms of how much you earn, yes. Yeah. But, I mean, one of my favorite stories is about this apparently brilliant jazz musician who lives on the streets of New York and busks.
And what?
Busks. He plays in the subways and things like that. Now, apparently, he is the expert in counterpoint, which is one of the trickier aspects of jazz composition. And every now and then, he gets hauled down to the police station, and he just calls up, when he gets his phone call, he calls up one or more of the other really top-flight jazz musicians. They come down, and they give the police hell for things like that. This is the guy we come to when we have trouble with counterpoint. What are you hassling him for? He doesn't care about earning money. He's not. It is crazy from our point of view, from those people who've bought into the conventions of life. It is completely crazy. You're quite right. But is it actually crazy? Well, I don't know. Is this big or is this bigger? Microphone for Kara and then Diane.
I'm not saying that it's wrong of him to live that life, but when you start talking about perceptions, I mean, there are entire communities devoted to trying to, like, self-help communities that are geared towards helping us change the way that we perceive situations because we are wrong-headed.
Yes.
And they're not, like, Buddhist, per se, but, you know, they're, I mean, pick a, you know, an A. They're all about, you know, learning how to perceive insanity.
Yes.
And in many ways, I mean, I would ask you, this man who's living in the subway, does he drink?
I have no idea. From the way this is reported, no. I mean, there wasn't anything wrong with him. It's just how he chose to live.
And you have to pay to go to those self-help things.
Go.
If you wave the microphone around like that, it doesn't get recorded.
I'm not sure I want to be heard. No, and I find that frustrating. Like, when you said that someone can sit on a stand and say, like, you're nuts, and I can say, no, I'm not, you know, like...
But yes, but they can trot out all the scientific evidence, proof, and it doesn't matter what you think about yourself. The court will judge you nuts because that's the system.
But why is that wrong?
Why? It isn't necessarily wrong, and many of those people, they might be seriously disturbed, but there is a way in which what is decided as acceptable or not acceptable behavior becomes what is insane or not insane.
Can I give a better example? There are some teachers who do not go after tenure, and many people say, what?
They're completely crazy.
They're completely crazy. Yeah. They don't choose to publish. They don't choose
to go through the pressure of getting tenure in a major university, and they are extremely loved by their students. But it causes great havoc because they do not choose tenure, which creates a lot of insecurity in their professional life.
Yeah.
That is an interesting study of mm-hmm. what happens to them when they don't do that, because it goes against the grain of everything you're supposed to work for.
And it goes against
life.
It goes the way. See what those
what
people.
So what is their value?
Yeah, but what the reason that those people are disliked so much by the system is that they reveal that the system does not actually value good education. They reveal that the system is primarily about producing money for the university through publications and reputation. And so they're exposing the fallacies within the university system. Yeah. Okay. Diane, you had a comment. Chuck, you have a mic up there. It's on.
Back to the jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily make the same assumption. I think that the anecdote about the jazz musician has conditioned sentimentality to it.
Okay.
And I think that there are assumptions that are made in the example that I don't think are proven out by the example. The idea that because he is so, I mean, we do also have this Western idea, the concept of specialness. The example that you stressed was that he had a profound gift. And we do value the idea that since he has a profound gift, how could he choose to reject the system that rewards the gift?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't make those assumptions from the story.
Okay.
And, you know, and the thing, and I think the thing that you've been talking about almost all class is the concept of how we measure things.
And that things leads to a certain way of interpreting experience.
Measuring things leads to a way of interpreting experience. And it is possible that the only way he can perform at all is to perform only in that condition. Because, you know, it's...
Maybe. I was just using it to illustrate a point, that's all.
And I was always saying that before I nod and say, yes, that does illustrate how it might mm-hmm. reject the god or human or titan realm. It doesn't necessarily.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now we come down to the human realm and the animal realm. This is where, actually, there is the least conditioning in these two realms. Least is probably not the right word. It's the conditioning is least solidified. And so there are more possibilities. There aren't possibilities in the animal realm because there is just not enough awareness operating or not enough attention. In the human realm, there is. And then we get into the four major and eight minor sufferings of the human realm. The four major sufferings are birth, old age, illness, and death. You'll notice from these descriptions of the birth process that the fetus is regarded as conscious from in some sense, from a very, very early stage, that it is actually responding to experience, and that is increasingly being corroborated by measurements of fetus awareness in the last couple of decades or so. So all of that is shifting in Western science. When before, I mean, for much of the 20th century, the fetus was regarded as inert matter that somehow started to became a human being at the moment of birth, but that view is changing mainly from the perspective from a lot of the inquiries coming from psychological conditioning. illness, everybody's familiar with that. I don't know how many of you had really serious illnesses, but, you know, I was on knocked out by flu a few weeks ago, and that was plenty unpleasant enough. I've had food poisoning a few times and dysentery and things like that. Haven't had anything like cholera or typhoid fever or the plague, etc. But they can be pretty horrendous, and cancer and so forth. old age. Diane loved the phrase, the 10 inconceivable sufferings of old age. T.S. Eliot, if I can find it. Yes, here we are. This is collected poems of T.S. Eliot, but it's from four quartets. In particular, it is Little Gidding. Let me disclose the gifts reserved for age to set a crown upon your lifetime's effort. First, the cold friction of expiring sense without enchantment, offering no promise, but bitter tastelessness of shadow fruit as body and soul begin to fall asunder. So the decline in the ability to taste and smell and sense things. Second, the conscious impotence of rage at human folly and the laceration of laughter at what ceases to amuse. And last, the rending pain of reenactment of all that you have done and been, the shame of motives late revealed, and the awareness of things ill done and done to others' harm which once you took for exercise of virtue. Enjoy. I love that passage. I think it just says it so well, even if he is a little wordy. The minor sufferings. Being with people we don't want to be with. Not being with people we do want to be with. It's the four minor sufferings, sorry. Four major and four minor, not the eight minor. Not having what we want. Not being able to keep what we have. I remember I had an office down in Orange County. I was working through the six realms with one person down there as a management consultant. And I gave him these four minor sufferings. And he just looked at me and said, "That's my life." He said everything in his life was concerned with one of those four things. Trying to hang out with the people that he wanted to be with, trying to avoid the people he didn't want to be with, trying to get what he didn't have, and trying to keep what he did have. And this actually describes the human condition very, very well. So something you might take note of is how much of your life energy is taken up with those four things. And it's usually a pretty substantial amount. Running around, trying to create the world that will make us feel good. And of course, as soon as we do, impermanence sets in, and then we're back in the whole soup again. Now, pardon? What did you say, Kara?
That's just sucky.
Well, on that cheery note, I think we've run out of time. Anyway, we may spend a little more time on the six realms because some other aspects that I want to touch on next week. But read ahead also on to karma, because that's we'll be starting on karma. I'm going to say this now because it's very important. Karma is almost always regarded as cause and effect. That's how it was first translated and introduced. it's not a very good translation at all. Increasingly, a number of us are using the language of evolution to describe the operation of karma. It is much closer, much more much closer to what is meant. And when Rinpoche was teaching us karma, he always drew a picture of a tree growing from a seed into a branch and into a trunk and into things like that, which is an evolutionary process. It's a growth process. It's not a cause and effect as we commonly understand cause and effect. So when you're reading the section or the chapter on karma, think of it in terms of evolution, of how actions evolve into experience results, not how actions cause results. And I think we'll go into it in detail next week, but I just want to present that as a way of looking at it. Okay? Any last questions before we close? Randy?
In general, Buddhism operates much more on the stick approach than the carrot. Why aren't there worlds for describing the worlds of compassion or empathy or generosity, the so-called positive emotions?
Well, I know this is quite the hot topic in psychology these days, studying the positive emotions. You have the carrot and the stick approach. There's a very interesting thing about the carrot approach. When the donkey starts to move, what do you do with the carrot?
Move it.
Exactly. Does the donkey ever get the carrot?
So that's representing the tightener.
So that really represents the tightener, the...
When you use the carrot approach, it's very, very easy to be conditioning the Titan realm into people trying to achieve rather than putting them into their own experience. And when you say that Buddhism uses the stick approach, you can certainly look at it that way, but I would suggest that... And this raises a much larger question, which I'll throw at you for consideration. Buddhism, at least in the way it's always been presented to me, tries to describe how things actually are, and does so equally for compassion. You know, this is what compassion is like, and then leaves it up to you to how you want to live. But it will show you. Buddhism provides the tools to get there. All of which is, as we know, a version of rational choice theory. Okay, how many people make their decisions rationally?
None.
So I find it very ironic, and this is something I've just started to think about, that here is Buddhism based, most of Buddhism's presentation is based on a theory that everybody, like economic theory, is based on a theory that everybody knows is invalid. So the question, I'll just throw this out to you, that I've been rolling around in my head is, if you don't rely on rational choice theory, what does it mean to be a teacher? I'll just leave that as a question. Can we do the dedication?